This keynote session is called The Art of Bootstrapping. What do you do if you're not yet venture fundable? You do what lots of wildly successful companies have done. You bootstrap. It worked for HP, Microsoft, Apple, Dell, and eBay. During this session, you'll learn the tricks and traps of bootstrapping, including some recent variations on the technique. This session is led by Bill Reichert, Managing Director, Garage Technology Ventures.
What we're going to talk about now is The Art of Bootstrapping, subtitled Alternative Lifestyles for When the VCs Say No. So, as you've probably guessed from the discussions thus far, it isn't necessarily easy to raise venture capital, and at some point in your career as an entrepreneur, you're almost certainly going to have to know how to bootstrap. You may have to bootstrap at the beginning, getting a company started. You may have to bootstrap forever, because it may turn out you just can't raise venture capital for the type of business that you want to build. So what I want to do in this session is shift a little now. We're going to be talking about more operational issues, the art of bootstrapping, how to run a company on very little resources. And in the next, 45 minutes I've got, talk about some of the different models, some of the different techniques and approaches to do bootstrapping. Now, as I do this, I am very humble in my approach to this, because I realize that out here in the audience, there is probably a lot more experience, expertise, and success at bootstrapping than there is just in my tiny little brain. I've seen a lot of companies, I've worked with a lot of companies, I've seen a lot of bootstrapping techniques, but I know that out here, there's a lot of talent in this. And so I want to take a little bit of a different tact for this particular session. And I want to make this, I would like to try to make this a 300-person roundtable discussion of bootstrapping. But I know that's not practical, so I'm not going to do that. But what I would like to do is I would like to engage your collective brains during this session to think about what you have done, what you have seen that has been successful in the bootstrapping process. And we're not going to be able to share it all right here, right now, in today's session. But what I would appreciate is if you have some insights, some ideas, some experiences to offer to this collective community we've created here, I'd really appreciate it if you email me, you know, tonight, tomorrow, after this conference. Email me at Reichert@garage.com. That's my email address, Reichert@garage.com. If you've got a brief pithy, concise insight idea to offer to this community, I'll collect that and we'll make that available as part of the conference materials later on. So put your thinking caps on. I want to try to engage your brains as we discuss the art of bootstrapping. Now, you may wonder, Garage Technology Ventures, you guys, you're a venture firm. Why are you talking about bootstrapping? Well, the reason we care about bootstrapping is because we're a small venture firm, and we can only provide a limited amount of capital. And so we want entrepreneurs who have embedded in their DNA the attitude of bootstrapping entrepreneurs. We want entrepreneurs to be capital efficient. We want entrepreneurs who know how to do a lot with little resources. We want entrepreneurs who are creative about making things happen without spending a lot of money. So as a small fund, we're very much enthusiastic about making sure that entrepreneurs know the most effective techniques of bootstrapping. Sometimes you'll hear, and I think all of our friends are out the door now, so a bigger fund may have the point of view, well, you can't really create an interesting company for less than $20 or $30 million of capital. We don't think that's true. In fact, if you look at some of the most successful companies in the history of the economy, what you'll discover is, gee, you know, an awful lot of really good companies were, in fact, bootstrapped. You know, these are brand-name companies that really got off the ground without venture capital. And then there are a whole bunch of other companies that really, they got started without venture capital. Subsequently, a lot of these companies did take some venture capital. Some of them took venture capital and never used it. But the point is, the reality is, most successful companies are bootstrapped. They're either bootstrapped all the way to success, or they're bootstrapped for some period of time to get them off the ground before they get more capital. So bootstrap is a critical success. Bootstrapping, the ability to bootstrap, is a critical success factor for every entrepreneur. It's not just about coming up with a great idea and finding venture capital. You got to know how to operate a company efficiently on little capital. Now, There are probably as many models for bootstrapping as there are companies. But what I've tried to do here is cluster them into four basic bootstrap models that represent flavors of bootstrap companies, how you can run a company as a bootstrap, either to grow big or to get to the point where you can be funded. Our favorite model, model number one, is, of course, the garage model. The garage model is very limited resources. You and your buddies are in your garage tinkering away, building whatever it is that you're building on evenings and weekends while you're supporting yourselves during your day job. That's kind of the standard Silicon Valley bootstrap model. But there are other models. And increasingly, you see the university bootstrap model, where it doesn't feel quite like bootstrapping, but what's happened is you have a number of companies that have done an awful lot of technological development in a university setting, either as graduate students or as faculty, or, you know, under research grants, government grants, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of technology is built. You might even start developing relationships with the commercial world in a university environment and be able to bootstrap the company in that environment before you emerge from the university and become an operating company. The third model that has been alluded to before is the so-called services-to-product model. A company that starts out as a consulting company, generally doing some form of IT or software development type of consulting, and in the course of that consulting process, develops a productized technology that then they can leverage their selling model by selling a product rather than just by selling their service. And then the fourth type of bootstrap model is kind of a variation on the theme, but it is a distinctly different model. It's a model where a larger customer has outsourced the development of a particular component of technology. And you, as a developing organization, probably a consulting firm, you go and develop it, but you make sure you license the rights for that technology to spin it out for other applications that are non-competitive. I've seen a number of companies that have taken that approach to developing interesting technologies on other people's nickels without using equity to do it. So those are some different models for bootstrapping a company without having venture capital. What is it that you've got to have embedded in your model to be successful as a bootstrap company? There are some key characteristics that you better have in your business model in order to bootstrap it for some period of time. Those include, first of all, obviously, low capital requirements. You don't have a big chunk of money up front in order to start your business. Now, Steve Jurvetson made the comment, for example, it's hard to start a nanotechnology company if you need some big multi-million dollar reactors to do things if you're, you know, a lone entrepreneur, and that's true. But there are ways to have low capital requirements and get into some of these other high capital businesses by leveraging other people's resources. And the example there, of course, is the university example. If you're within a university or a national lab setting or even a corporate basic research facility, you might have access to some incredible capital infrastructure that you can use just to create the next generation product. The issue there, again, is make sure you get your intellectual property rights straight. You got to be upfront about the fact that you're using other people's capital. Then you've got to be careful about the way in which you license out the technology from that. Alternatively, though, most companies you think of as bootstrap companies, and then the normal order of the day, are companies that are like software companies or appliance-like companies that don't have huge capital requirements up front, where you can create something very interesting in your garage or in your den. The second characteristic is you got to have a low cost of customer acquisition. Now, this is a dimension of building any operating business that a lot of entrepreneurs don't really get their heads around, is what does it really cost to go acquire customers? And you have to have a model where one way or another you can get to your target customer base, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, some techniques to reduce the cost of customer acquisition. You got to have a model that enables you to start building customers, whether it's one by one or whether it's many at a time, relatively cheaply. Third characteristic is you want to have rapid cash flow in the business. You got to have some sort of business where you don't have to be the banker to your customers and finance their accounts payable, which become your accounts receivable. So make sure if you're trying to bootstrap a company, you want to put in place some sort of business processes that either make people pay up front or some very rapid way of collecting on the service or product that you're delivering. And then fourth, ideally you have a recurring revenue with those customers. Ideally, you've got some sort of model where they have to keep buying more, or some large percentage of them will keep buying more, whether it's re-upping on a subscription basis, or whether it's extending down a product suite, or whether it's expanding the number of seats they've licensed. Somewhere in your model should be a model for recurring revenue in the business. That's part of, one, improving cash flow, and two, reducing the cost of customer acquisition. So look at your own business models and say, is there anything I can do to improve the characteristics of my business model so that my business model is more bootstrappable up until the point that I will be able to raise more capital? Now, when we talk about bootstrapping, we talk about operating a business on low resources. But that doesn't mean no resources. Any company, if you're going to build an interesting company, it's going to take some cash somewhere. You got to eat. You got to pay the mortgage. And, you know, David's got to get braces. So you got to figure out some way to find some level of resources. So here is a list of 9 alternative sources of financing for the bootstrap model. Source number 1 is your day job. And that's frankly, you know, where we see a lot of, you know, typical garage bootstrap models. Don't quit your day job until you have the resources to do so. So, you know, guys, women who are working in other companies, working weekends and nights, et cetera, in the garage, using their day job to fund their startup vision. And 2, credit cards and mortgages, 2nd mortgages, 3rd mortgages. You know, we are working, I'm not sure if Mike is still here in the room, but great example of a brilliant company that with a brilliant idea that the VCs just didn't get it. Everybody except for us, of course, just didn't get it. And these guys, God bless them. You know, they ran up the credit cards, they ran up their mortgages, incredibly patient spouses, and they funded this company to profitability. 3, source number 3 are the so-called 3 F's, friends, fools, and family. Those are, you know, sort of some of the traditional sources of the very earliest capital. Now, we talked before about being careful where you get this money. There are strings attached to any money you take. So you got to be careful about particularly the fool's part of it. But, you know, friends and family, you want to be careful about as well. You want to make sure when you take money, whether it's, you know, $5,000 chunks or $50,000 chunks from angel investors, friends, fools, and family, that you do it the right way. And I talked about that a little bit before. You got to be careful if you know, your buddy is going to be calling you every day asking you about his $5,000 and how you're doing with it. You know, that may cost more than that $5,000 is worth. So you're in a desperate strait. You really want that money. You're looking for any money you can. But understand there is a cost to some of this money before you take it. Source 4, a founding angel. You know, we had Ian on stage here before. There are angels all over the country who are a source of initial capital, seed capital, to get you going. I think we've talked a little bit about that already. Item 5 are government grants. And this is something we've seen a lot of increasingly recently, in spite of the fact that at some levels the government has been cutting back on grants, we're seeing an increasingly sophisticated pool of entrepreneurs who are very successful at tapping this source of funding. Now, it's particularly a high target source of funding if you happen to be within a university while you're bootstrapping your organization. We've also seen entrepreneurs who sort of reach back into the university from the outside, either via grad students or faculty, because the fact of the matter is that generally expertise about getting government grants as well as credibility around getting government grants is enhanced by being affiliated with a research and nationally known, internationally known research university or a government lab of some sort. So if you want it, this is a path that you can go down, and there's this process to going down this path, and some of you know a lot about this, I know. Item six are incubators. Now, we have always been disparaging of incubators over the years, and generally incubators have had a lot of problems associated with them. But there is a point in time, there are some incubators that can provide some resources when all else fails. They can provide just some physical resources, some additional intellectual resources, and some, in some cases, even financial resources. So investigate the incubators, you know, in your regions, in your areas, and find out whether or not this is a sufficient, if this is an interesting leverage source for you. Number seven, license rights. One company that we worked with a couple of years ago raised a very significant chunk of money, a group of guys who had developed a very interesting technology. In their prior lives, they had done a lot of work in Asia, and particularly in Japan. And so reaching out to Japan for the possibility of financing or customer relationships, one of the things they found was a company that was interested in the license rights for their technology in Japan and were willing to pay a big chunk of money up front for exclusive license rights for that technology in Japan. You know, a nice six-figure check, but the quid pro quo was they gave away Japan. Now, that's a calculus you got to do for yourselves if you can even get that far. But there are ways in which you can get non-equity funding by selling license rights in certain markets that you either weren't going to get to for a long time or you were never going to get to, and there's an interested party there. Source number eight is the core customer model that I talked about before. If you got a team of guys that can develop a piece of technology for a company that needs a piece of technology in a non-competitive domain to where you're going, maybe you sell yourselves as consultants or a development shop to develop this core technology in some other person's nickel, making sure you protect your IP, your intellectual property rights, and you can use that technology in other applications. And then the ninth source of financing for bootstrapping a company is version 1.0. It's customers. As you know, we like to say, there's no better financing for an earlier stage company than revenues. Boy, it's great on all fronts. It reduces your equity requirements. It gives you traction in the marketplace. It validates the business that you're in. So one of the best sources, if you can get there, of financing for a bootstrap company is version 1.0. Just go get customers and sell your product. Now, operating a company as a bootstrapping entrepreneur involves understanding at a very, very tight degree the economics of your business. And so it's very important to understand every decision you make of allocating resources, what is the return on that investment? Now, I don't know how many of you are MBAs, and I will scandalize some of my professors from business school taking this approach, because what you're trained in finance at business school is it's about return on investment. You know, it's the return on the capital deployed. It's not just about payback. This is an important part of financial theory that's drummed into MBAs. But the reality is when you're an entrepreneur running a bootstrap company, it is about payback. You got to think, every time you put a dollar down, when am I going to get $3 back on that dollar? Because if I'm going to get $3 back in 2 years, that doesn't help me a lot. If I can get $2 back in 2 weeks, that helps me a lot. So I want to look at every decision I make and look at the payback on that decision. When can I get cash back for cash out in each dimension of running my business? And so if you're a very well-funded, venture-backed startup company who's got several million dollars to go build the product that you want to deliver to the market, you got a big engineering team, and you're going to make sure that this thing is engineered to perfection. If you're a bootstrap company, you can't afford to put all of the features into that product that you wish you could put in. You've got to figure out what features, what expenditures, how many extra days can you afford to put into developing a product before you can ship it. And so when you're bootstrapping a company, you've got to be very tight about figuring out what is the minimum product that is substantially enough different in the marketplace that I can get the price I need to get for shipping that product out the door. And you're going to have these horrific fights with your CTO about, you know, oh my God, no, we got to get this feature in, or we have to get this capability in, or we have to include this protocol in the product. But you just don't have the time or the money to do that. You've got to figure out an alternate path to ship a product to a narrower target of customers and then continuously build in the features as the market demands them, rather than building everything you wish you could build and then shipping that. Similarly, with your marketing and communications effort, your promotion efforts. Again, if you've got somebody on the team whose background is marketing and promotion, you know, they're going to have wonderful, grandiose plans for these marketing launches and these PR events, et cetera, that you're going to wish you can do, but you just don't have the money to do it. So you've got to figure out ways to market this product on the cheap, and I'm going to talk in a second about some techniques to market on the cheap. Same with sales expenses, similarly with overhead. Everything you do as a company, look at the payback on dollars out the door and figure out a way you can reduce the cost of selling, you can increase the cash flow from selling, you can eliminate the overhead by using other people's facilities. Again, the irony of a bootstrapped entrepreneur is, in so many ways, the bootstrap entrepreneur has to be more sophisticated than the well-funded entrepreneur. Because the bootstrap entrepreneur has got to be able to model out in great detail exactly the economics of every decision he or she makes. Okay, let's talk a little bit more detail about each of these operational elements of your bootstrap company. Let's talk about bootstrapping product development. How do you minimize the cost of product development? There are several techniques that you can follow to minimize the cost of product development. Some of these we've talked a little about before. Of course, you can work nights and weekends, fund it with your day job. Don't use paid resources to develop your version 1.0. Another source has been a great source around here is you use PhD students in a university environment who need a dissertation project. I mean, that's basically what Google was. Google did a whole bunch of its product development within the context of their Stanford PhD projects, got a whole heck of a lot of technology developed, in essence, for free using that approach. If you're outside the university and you can reach back into it and find PhD students who are aligned with what you're doing, God bless, they might even have some grants in your domain, that might be some leverage points for you. You might be able to get some of those students nights and weekends outside of their dissertation, outside of their grant project, to help you with development. Technique number three, tap offshore resources. Now, this is a little controversial, and some of us disagree on this. We had this debate, in fact, at lunch. If you have spent your entire career, you know, here, and you're starting up a new company, and you're trying to figure out how do I develop on the cheap, and you say, well, okay, why don't we just fly over to Bangalore and then hire a bunch of programmers because we pay them a lot less? That's probably not a good idea. But the reality is, a lot of you in the room, a lot of people who are starting up companies now, already have experience with offshore resources, particularly in product development. We see probably one out of three companies that come in the door that we see these days come in the door already having offshore development taking place in one way or another. And so for some entrepreneurs, being able to tap offshore resources even before they have venture capital is a particular blessing of the current international globalization of technology development. So if from your previous life you've brought some relationships from India, from China, from Israel, from Moscow, that enable you to tap some low-cost resources. There, I think Svetlazar is in the back there somewhere from Romania. To tap some resources to develop on the cheap, that could be a very powerful advantage for your company, where you can, with very little resources, develop some amazingly powerful technology. And number four is the idea that I mentioned before, of productizing a consulting project, or using a customer to develop your product, where you've been hired for consulting, or there's a company that's willing to pay you non-recurring engineering expenses. That's what NRE stands for. I'm sure most of you know that. Or somebody's willing to fund the development of a particular piece of technology on their nickel, not on yours. And again, make sure you have the right attorney available to your firm to make sure that you, when you sign the contract with that company, you get the intellectual property rights to take that technology somewhere else. Another approach we've seen is you can license a finished product. Now, there are a lot of sources for licensing finished products. Again, I go back to the university. There's a lot of technology in a lot of universities and national laboratories. There's a lot of technology in a lot of corporations. There's technology overseas that you might want to bring to the United States or vice versa. Generally, if you don't already have the links or the relationships into these entities, this is going to be a very hard way to do it. Mostly when we see this product development model in place, it's in place because somebody on the team has this relationship with this national lab and knows about this technology, or has this relationship with this aerospace corporation and was involved in the development of the technology. So if you have the luxury of having somebody on your team already linked into this, look at this as an opportunity to get much more advanced and fully developed technology into your organization for the price of a licensing agreement if you can work it out for non-cash. Idea number six is to import a finished product. Now, this is generally not a venture capital fundable model downstream, but clearly throughout history, this has been one of the keys of economic development. It applies in technology as well. There are some very interesting technologies elsewhere in the world. It's hard to believe that not all great technologies were invented here in Silicon Valley, but we have seen, needless to say, lots of cases where, in essence, teams have imported technology from Israel or from China or from elsewhere in the world and used that as a finished product to launch a company here in the United States. The point is, you want to figure out a way to get to a finished product that can generate revenues as fast as you're possibly able. Let's talk a little bit about bootstrap selling. How is it that you can minimize the cost of customer acquisition when you're bootstrapping your company? Again, it is one of the biggest non-recognized costs of business is the cost of customer acquisition. Because for whatever reason, GAAP accounting and CPAs and the financial industry, they can't think about it in that way. And so usually when we ask an entrepreneur, well, what's the cost of acquiring a customer in your business? They don't have that number because the discipline of measuring the cost of customer acquisition just isn't embedded in business practices. But it is embedded in experienced entrepreneurs. And you know that every day when you're paying payroll that you do not acquire a customer, that's an added cost. So the cost of acquiring a customer isn't just about marketing and advertising. It's the cost of the sales force. It's the cost of the overhead that you're not recovering from selling product. So you got to figure out, if you're bootstrapping, how do you minimize the cost of customer acquisition? A few ideas. One is, rifle shot selling. You can't just build a better mousetrap and hope that the world will be the path to your door. You've got to know who wants version 0.9 of that mousetrap. You've got to know who's going to be willing to pay for the first one off of your quote-unquote assembly line. You got to find those companies. And you cannot just do broad-based shotgun-type marketing, advertising, communication to go find those customers. You've got to use a rifle to go find them. You've got to go after them and make sure, well before your product is ready to sell, that you know the first 5 or 10 individual buyers within the companies you're targeting that will buy your product. And you pre-qualify them before you ship. And you make sure that they're ready to buy it when you're ready to ship. That's rifle shot selling, and it is hand-to-hand combat, and you've got to be willing to get doors slammed in your face. But you've got to invest the resources to make sure that you're going to have a customer when your product is ready to ship. Now, what we all learned a lot about in the bubble was the idea that selling should be viral. And so we've heard about viral selling. We've heard about word-of-mouth selling. Ideally, what you're talking about there is community selling. What you're trying to do is you're trying to find a community of similar individuals or corporations that should have a shared interest in the new technology, the new product, the new service that you're going to offer, and who will be willing, because of the dynamics of that community, to share information about a new product that's out the door. And there are lots of ways in which communities do this, either at the individual level, and you think of teenage girls at that level, or even at the corporate level. And you think of IT managers at the corporate level who do community selling among themselves. They find a better tool, they tell other people about that better tool. So in your particular business, you've got to figure out, are there communities of interest that are going to be really, really interested in the product that you're developing that will leverage you, that will help you sell more than one copy of your product across that community? It's a variation on word of mouth. It's a variation on viral. It's about identifying communities of interest who are interested in your product. Third, channel sales. Now, this is controversial as well. I hear a lot of investors, a lot of entrepreneurs, whose comment is, well, gee, you know, building a channel that takes time and energy and effort, and you can't afford to build channels when you're bootstrapping a company. You know, you just got to find the customers. Well, that's not always true, and there are lots of contrary examples to that. Company that we have invested in, a few guys literally in a garage, they built a better mousetrap, and for the most part, they were engineers. And they did not know the customers for this product. They sure knew the technology for this product, but they didn't really know the customers. Who knew the customers? Well, there were resellers in the industry in which they were focused on. And there were consultants who consulted to the companies that they were interested in selling to. So rather than hire some expensive VP of sales who could do direct selling for their product, which they couldn't afford and they wouldn't be able to attract them anyway, what they did is they went out to these channel partners and they said, hey, we've got this better mousetrap. Do you know people who could use it? And some people slammed the door in their faces, but a whole bunch of these VARs, systems integrators, consultants said, boy, that's great. That solves a big problem that our customers have that we're involved in. And these guys, four guys in a garage, managed to build a profitable company doing virtually no direct selling by building a channel sales force from their garage. It's a phenomenal model, and I think more companies can exploit that approach if they've got the right kind of product and the right kind of channel structure in their industry. A variation on that is developing OEM partnerships or private label deals. Go find another corporation or a set of corporations that can incorporate your technology, your product, into their product line. Get them to build it into their product line. Preferably, it's embedded and it's not an option. But to the extent that you can leverage your sales force by doing that, it's another way to reduce the cost of customer acquisition in building out your model. Then, of course, there is the internet. We can't ignore the internet. Done right, you can leverage your selling efforts by promotion across the internet. And that can include, affiliate networks. It include AdWords and other techniques like that. Consulting, again, I think I talked about before, if you have the ability to go call on to build a consulting practice in technology, that's a way to pre-qualify and identify possible customers for your product. And there are a number of other different techniques I'm sure all of you know. Again, put on your thinking caps. Feel free to share your ideas with this community after the conference. The bottom line, though, is you have to figure out a way to reduce the cost of customer acquisition and then design in repeat sales in your selling process. The next dimension is bootstrap marketing. There are a lot of techniques here that don't cost all that much when you're marketing your product. Now, I hope Betty is out of the room now, or all professional PR firms are out of the room. First thing you hear when you go to a professional PR firm is, it takes a long time and a lot of money to build out a good professional PR strategy, and I will be the first to say, yes, that is absolutely true. But there are some cases where you can't afford that, and there are some ways to do PR directly as a bootstrap organization that will enable you to get the word out about your business without hiring an expensive PR agency. You might be able to hire a freelance PR person, but What you want to do is there should be a relatively small community of influencers in your industry who are part of the part of the media in your industry, part of the intelligentsia of your industry that you can target. Go find those people and tell them your story. Get their feedback, make them your friends. Now, that's what a PR agency should do for you, but if you can't afford a PR agency, spend the time. It'll give you a lot of feedback on your product development as well. Similarly, there are ways to do events and seminars and webinars that can be relatively cost-effective to do, particularly if you can find a partner to do them for you or with you. Leverage off other people. Bootstrap entrepreneurs, you will find them in someone else's booth at the trade show. They figure out a way to get someone else to allow them into their booth at the big trade shows. Directories, you know, in some industries this matters. You got to make sure you're listed in the directories. The analysts, it's like going after the PR. Find the thought leaders in your industry and get to know them and let them get to know the product and technology you're working on so they can recommend you and include you in their reports even though you're a startup. Affiliate marketing programs on the web are very cost-effective. AdWords are increasingly cost-effective. And again, it depends on the sector you're in, the business you're in, but we have come across bootstrapping entrepreneurs who are discovering that Google AdWords are the greatest things to slice bread in terms of customer acquisition. They're getting an incredible payback on buying AdWords and generating qualified leads. In some industries, this is a great boon. This is a whole new technique available to you. In other industries, it won't work. You've got to decide for your own business. But again, and then one other broad-based approach to the whole approach of marketing is to leverage the expense that the leader in the market is putting into marketing in your industry. What do I mean by that? Well, usually in your sector, there may be a company out there that's doing the market development work. They're doing the business of explaining to the enterprises in America that the enterprises in America need to look at these new technologies as part of the next wave of technology they're going to implement. Find the leader in the sector that you can leverage their story, leverage their market development, such that if somebody is about to go, if somebody's about to go out there and buy a product, they should know about you. Because of all the market development work that the leader has done, they're out there shopping for a product. If you get enough market awareness out there, they're going to have to consider you alongside the market leader when they make their purchase decision. It's a very high leverage way of getting into the market. Okay, so let's go through some other operational techniques, and then we'll wrap this up. Recruiting is another big area that early stage companies struggle with because they don't have the resources to recruit. And there are a number of techniques you can use to add talent. To add talent to your organization without spending a lot of money. Again, you can network your friends and advisors, take advantage of the universities, go pilfer from your competitors. If you have to spend money, the way to do it is with contract recruiters, not with retained recruiters. They're contract recruiters, you spend a few thousand dollars, and they can help you source a list of 15 or 20 qualified entrepreneurs. What I put up here is not Monster. A lot of entrepreneurs think, well, gee, Monster's relatively cheap and free. In some cases, there are other online resources that are free. My own bias on this is it's more cost than it's worth. If you get 150 unqualified resumes, you're going to spend more time sifting through them, and maybe you'll find someone useful. I would recommend other resources other than things like Monster for recruiting on the cheap. The point is, though, you need to figure out a way to find talent that is bought into your vision. The most effective way to recruit is not dollars. The most effective way to recruit is evangelism. It's about finding people who believe in your vision, finding other people who want to see you succeed. So that as you're growing, they're constantly referring talent to you, and you're referring a set of talent that can be helpful for you. Bootstrap operations, same issue here. You've got to focus on the core for what you need to succeed. To the extent possible, shift the other stuff off of your books. So when I talk about core versus not core, in most companies, the product design, the sales, and the customer support in an early-stage company are core. You've got to have people on your team who are doing that. But in a lot of companies, writing code is not core. You can get, you know, somebody's brother at the university or somebody's cousin in Romania to write the code and still manage that from the core. You can outsource some marketing to some freelancers or some other cheap sources. You can outsource your overhead by being in an incubator or being in a university or in your friend's garage. You can outsource manufacturing by finding another company whose expertise is manufacturing, because you're not going to have to be able to develop yourself. Bottom line again, we've talked about ecosystem. Leverage the talent, the skills, the resources in your ecosystem when you're putting together your operating plan. So the question then becomes, you've figured out how to bootstrap. You've gotten very efficient. You know, do you want to do bootstrapping or do you want to do venture capital? Well, here are some questions to ask yourself to make this decision, whether you're going to go down the bootstrap path indefinitely or go after venture capital. One, do you have a business model that's bootstrappable? Those are the criteria that I talked about before. Two, do you have the discipline to manage this bootstrap model? Do you have the ability to model out expenses and determine whether or not they're going to pay back? Do you have the resilience when you make mistakes to recover from those mistakes? Do you have access to leverageable resources, other resources in your community, in your ecosystem that can reduce your costs? And is it just too painful to raise venture capital? A lot of entrepreneurs, they spend months and months and months pounding their head against the brick wall of venture capital trying to raise the money. It may be because they never can raise venture capital, or it may be that they just can't raise venture capital now. So if these are the case, then maybe bootstrapping is perfectly acceptable. Remember, many of the best companies in the world have been bootstrapped. The flip side of this is, okay, you've gone down the bootstrapping path. When do you switch over? When do you say, okay, I've gone far enough, now let's go back and pursue venture capital? Well, the first clue is when the VCs start to call. You know, this is a quality problem. It doesn't mean you'll necessarily get venture capital, because I'll tell you, VCs are calling a lot of entrepreneurs right now because VCs are hungry, believe it or not. But if the VCs start to call, you know, answer the call. Second, if the product that you cooked up in your garage and the market you're operating in all of a sudden becomes hot, you want to make sure you get that word to the investor community. When you tried it 6 months ago, it may be that there wasn't much interest or awareness or understanding of the product market you were going after. All of a sudden, you know, the world changes quickly. The world may suddenly discover that the technology, the domain, the problem you're solving is a big, important, fat, hot problem. Wake up and consider going back to the community and letting them know the progress you've made along these lines, because you could all of a sudden become a hot property in the venture community. Third, when you went to the VCs before, it may have been you had a model, but you had no validation of that model. Once you can validate your revenue projections, the time, you know, your selling cycle, the profitability of customers, once you have 3, 4, 12 customers and you can validate it, that may be a threshold point where investors will now be interested in your business. Similarly, you validated the payback models. You know how much it costs to acquire a customer, how much it costs to build a product, how much it costs to generate a qualified lead. And even better, if you get the company to a point where you're at break even, then you have many more degrees of freedom. And so again, we worked with a company exactly like this, where we worked with them as they were bootstrapping all the way up until the point that they were at break even. Once you're at break even, you have a lot more flexibility in your business. Now, there's always the risk that in a given month there's going to be a hiccup. But once you're at break even, you don't have to raise the money. You may want to raise the money, but you don't have to. And by taking the desperation out of your eyes, you're going to be more successful with venture capitalists. When venture capitalists see that you are not desperate for their money, they're going to be more interested in giving you money. Sounds counterintuitive, but that's the reality. And lastly, you know, one of the great opportunities for raising money is when you're profitable. And that's the kind of situation where you can actually write the term sheet yourself rather than being subject to others. And finally, I guess, the answer to this question, when do I give up on bootstrapping and go after venture capital, could very well be never. As I said before, Lots of great companies never did raise venture capital. There are a lot of very wealthy entrepreneurs who got very wealthy by not raising venture capital. So it isn't the only path to follow.
To learn more about this topic and other subjects that will help you build a great company, be sure to read Guy Kawasaki's latest book, The Art of the Start. It will be available in the first week of September from online bookstores as well as brick-and-mortar bookstores. Thank you very much.